Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, a monthly show devoted to the creative life. My guest today is Benjamin Sweat, writer, photographer, author of three books, Route 22, The Hudson Valley, A Cultural Guide, and most recently, New York City of Trees. Before the interview starts, the first movement of Antonio Vivaldi's Concerto for Two Cellos, performed by Yo-Yo Ma and Jonathan Manson with the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Tan Koopman. The second movement halfway through the interview, the third movement at the end. So here is Vivaldi, followed by Benjamin Sweat. My guest today is Benjamin Sweat, a photographer
and author.
Has published three books, including most recently New York City of Trees.
Well, I published a fourth book for the Parks Department when I worked there, called Great Trees of New York City, A Guide. And the research for that book and the beginning tree photography in New York City was what ultimately set me on the road to doing this latest book.
How long did you work for the Parks Department?
I worked for the Parks Department for 13 years, and I didn't quite realize I would be working there that long, but it turned out to be a really interesting place, both in terms of the subject matter, which was all of the nature in all of New York City, and in terms of what I was able to do there, which was basically to run a publications program about parks. So I did a number of different brochures and booklets describing the history and layout of different parks around the city.
And you had some background, I guess, in that sort of work or that sort of interest?
In the sense that I had worked as a newspaper reporter and done a lot of writing, and basically writing and photography were my skills I came out of college with. And though I, in the beginning in the Parks Department, didn't get to use them as much as I would like to have, by the end, that was basically what I was doing for the agency.
Did you study journalism in college?
Nope, I studied English.
And how long were you in the newspaper business?
Just about a year and a half. I worked for a biweekly newspaper in Westchester, and based in Mount Kisco, called the Patent Trader Newspaper. It was a great place to work. I had two towns that were mine, and I was basically the editor of the section of the newspaper that covered those towns. So I wrote about everything from the heavy political battles, local housing development problems and questions, and, you know, strange car accidents that occurred and other unexpected events in the town. And my towns were actually the towns of Chappaqua and Newcastle and another town nearby.
And I guess that was before the Clintons moved to Chappaqua?
Well before the Clintons moved to Chappaqua, yes.
So the Parks Department was kind of the genesis of the New York City of Trees.
It was, yes. I started working for the Parks Department really because I was in the subway one day and I saw there was something called the New York Job List. And in the New York Job List, it listed all kinds of city jobs. And under the Parks Department, it said that the Parks Department is looking for plumbers, lifeguards, writers, and electricians. And I thought it was so great that writers were considered a trade, as opposed to something, glamorous and fancy, that I decided I'd like to work there. And that's how I really ended up there, and ended up doing all kinds of different things and getting to know New York City and its trees sort of almost as part of that job.
Where is the headquarters for the Parks Department?
It's in Central Park, in the Arsenal Building.
Ah, so that was a nice place to go to work also.
It was very nice, yes. We looked out on the seals in the Central Park Zoo from our office.
And then more recently you had a show at the Arsenal Gallery, that same building.
Yes. Ever since working there, I had known about this amazing space on the second floor in the center of this 19th century building that was built before Central Park. And it has been used as a gallery for quite some years. And when I was doing the photographs for this book, the color photographs, I knew I wanted to make large prints and that I wanted to hang them in the Arsenal Gallery because they would look so great there because it's such a big space. And I was very lucky that Jonathan Kuhn, who runs the gallery, and the Parks Department permitted me to do that, asked me to do it.
Now, and so you went around the city scouting trees?
Well, because of that earlier book, I knew a number of the great trees of New York City, the designated great trees. And that book had been black and white and was published by the Parks Department and really, as a book, didn't go anywhere because the Parks Department is not in the business of distributing books. And in 2001, I left the Parks Department to continue doing photography on my own. And I basically went from being a city employee to being a freelance photographer. And I did a lot of different things after leaving the Parks Department in terms of photography, but I kept photographing trees. Only I photographed them at a certain point mainly in color. And I found myself revisiting all the trees from the first book, or some of the trees from the first book. I also visited some from the first book that I'd never gotten to, that I'd never photographed, though I'd written about them. And then I began seeing different trees around the city that weren't considered great and that weren't the oldest or the biggest, but interested me for other reasons. And I began to realize that all of the trees in the city, in their own ways, contain parts of the stories of the neighborhoods where they grow. They really carry on the history of the city in rather interesting ways. So I began exploring that idea in the different boroughs and it, just photographing sometimes tiny trees that no one would even notice, but I like them as well as the big ones.
You said designated great trees. What exactly is that?
Well, in 1985, the then Parks Commissioner, Henry Stern, designated 120 great trees around the city. He'd sent a letter around to community groups asking for nominations, and from the nominations of the community groups, I don't know, there were probably 200 or 300 nominations, he and his forestry staff and people in the agency narrowed it down to 120. And from 1985, this list existed, and that my first book, The 2000 Great Trees of New York City Guide that I did for them, was the fullest treatment given of several earlier treatments to those great trees. By the time I did that book, though, there were no longer 120. There were only 106 left, and they've continued being lost since that date.
What goes into that?
There were a very specific number of criteria. It was the age, the size, the species, or the historical association. And there are a lot of trees in New York City that are often old or interesting, but that are associated with important people or events or historical events in the city's past. And so that was what was recorded in that particular book. And of course, the oldest and biggest trees were often the ones that had
a history.
Had a history, but also ones that reached the end of their lives at a certain point, so were lost.
And I guess it depends on the species. Some trees last for a very, very long time. I know of one in Sri Lanka that's 2,000, more than 2,000 years old.
Oh, they're extremely old trees. There's trees in this country that are that age. The bristlecone pines out in California. And, of course, the giant sequoias and redwoods.
And then other trees like a poplar will last 20 or 30 years or something, right?
Well, one of the interesting things in New York City that I discovered about trees is that, and that in general I've discovered about trees, it's not always the big trees that are the oldest trees. And in fact, the oldest documented tree in New York City is a tree that is only 20 inches in diameter. In fact, it's one of the smallest trees that I photographed in my book.
What type of tree is that?
It is a post oak. Post oaks are, they thrive in Texas. And in fact, this is, New York is pretty much the northern end of its range. And there's this group of post oaks, which are smaller oak trees with a very strong wood used to make posts and fences by early settlers. But these post oaks were all growing along the shore in Pelham Bay Park. And another wonderful writer about trees in New York City named Ned Barnard, who sort of like me likes to wander around the city looking at trees, discovered these trees and asked the Parks Department for permission to have somebody core the trees. And to stick a borer into them and pull out a sliver of wood and then actually measure the rings of the tree. And these small trees, which sort of hang over Long Island Sound, they're sort of buffeted by the salt water and the winds off Long Island Sound. You'd never notice them, really, because they're so small, were cored by Neil Peterson of Columbia University's Tree Ring Lab. And he cored 20 of them and discovered that these little trees all date back to the American Revolution, and some of them predate the American Revolution. And we established that they were growing in their current locations during the Battle of Pell's Point during the American Revolution, when after Washington and the American Army retreated from Manhattan, they were drawing the English back into the woods of the Bronx and Westchester, as we now call them, and that happened then. All of these trees connect to different periods in the city's history and tell you something about the city. That one of the things I learned from this man, Neil Peterson, is that, of course, trees every year absorb carbon from the atmosphere. And each year's layer of wood, which becomes a ring in the tree, is composed of, is formed from carbon that is absorbed from the atmosphere. And dendrochronologists, the people who study tree rings, can determine from those rings, from the amount of carbon absorbed, how much sunlight surrounded the tree in that particular year, whether there was a change in the amount of sunlight around the tree, how much, you know, other carbon might have been in the atmosphere. One of the things they can measure is human burning of fossil fuels can be observed in the rings of trees throughout the world. And so one can think of the trees growing anywhere as libraries recording, or as archives recording year by year information about the places that they grow. And so even the youngest trees, I have a tree in my book, a little honey locust growing beside the Long Island Expressway. You know, it's maybe 20 years old, or it was when I photographed it. Each of those 20 years of being by the Long Island Expressway and all the people that happen to drive and walk by are held inside that particular tree.
You have any particular favorite types of trees?
Well, it's hard not to be emotionally involved with the American elm, which was planted, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, all around New York City. It was planted along streets. It was planted in parks. And, of course, the Dutch elm disease, which was introduced into this country, has been slowly destroying elms in the city and across the country. What's interesting about New York City is there are still many elms remaining along streets, these trees that were planted as street trees, you know, in the 1870s, and are now these enormous specimens hanging over streets, and some of them are still there. You think that, you know, in some sense they're often doomed. In fact, one of the elms I photographed for my book, I went back with a reporter a few years after taking the picture and to show him this tree, and it was gone. It turned out it had been, that Dutch elm disease had taken it out. But it's a beautiful tree, and the fact that it's that it does have this, it's so fragile and yet has been there for so long, is very evocative, I think.
And they're so beautiful, the way they sort of hang over the street, right?
Yes.
They make a kind of an arch if they're on both sides.
They do make an arch, and what's amazing is to think is when they were first planted and they had begun to arch over, their branches were hanging over horse-drawn streetcars going down muddy dirt streets in many places.
On your website, you had a story of a tree in four or five parts. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
Yes. As I said before, I find trees that interest me for themselves. So, and there was a beautiful calorie pear tree on 11th Avenue between 25th and 26th Streets, right on the western side of Chelsea. It was on the eastern side of 11th Avenue, right smack between 25th and 26th Streets, in front of a parking lot. And when I first saw it, my wife and I were walking by and looked up, and some sun was angling just perfectly between two post office buildings across the street to sort of brilliantly light up this tree as if with a spotlight. And the calorie pear is planted all over New York City. It's a very popular street tree because it has such a nice, it's small, it has a nice form, and it turns a brilliant orangey red in the fall. It has wonderful white blossoms in the spring and great leaves in the summer. So anyway, I came back and I photographed that tree in that summer, and then I knew it was going to be absolutely beautiful in the fall, so I decided I'd come back and photograph it in the same kind of light at the same time of day in the fall. So I came back, went to the same spot, but of course the light wasn't coming through the post office buildings. It was shooting up 11th Avenue, because by that point it was, I don't know, November or something. It was much more in the south. So I got a very different angle of view on this tree and a different sense of it. But as with the first frame by this building behind it. Well, I got very excited about this and decided I would come back in the winter and then in the spring. So I photographed it in all four seasons in exactly the same position with exactly the same different kinds of light each time, but from the same angle. And this became a kind of a, I don't know, almost a signature tree for me. I mean, I made postcards of it. I send it around to people, and people to this day identify me with that tree. They, you know, and so of course, I was going by that same spot a number of years later in 2008, and I looked up, and the tree was gone. It just no longer was there, and behind it were these enormous construction cranes, and the parking lot had been turned into just the most busy construction site you can imagine. Well, having worked at the Parks Department, I contacted the head forester at the time, Fiona Watt, and asked about it. And she did some research, and she said, "Oh yes, well that tree was taken out with permission. In fact, MTA paid the city, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority paid the city $26,000." for permission to remove that tree, and the $26,000 will be used to plant new trees around it in the same area. This is something that happens all over New York City in these cases. And so I went back and photographed the site where the tree had been. So I now have call it the Five Seasons of a Calorie Pear, that particular series.
Is there a limit on how large a tree can be transplanted?
Well, it's possible to transplant pretty enormous trees. I am saying that because I just walked by the Metropolitan Museum the other day and noticed that the really old London planes that were planted in front of the museum as part of the new renovation of the whole front of the museum, these trees have all been removed. And I'm assuming this is something I need to look into, that they have been taken out and are being preserved and will be replanted after the construction is done. I mean, these are trees that have been growing there for most of my life. They've got to be 40 or 50 years old, and they're quite big. If they've been actually cut down, I'm going to be very upset. So I don't know the answer to this question. But if you go by some nurseries, especially out on Long Island, where people tend to want to instantly have a large tree, you can see some pretty enormous trees in burlap casings.
Have you planted any trees in your place here in Ghent?
I have, yes. I love planting trees, actually. We planted a peach tree, and nothing enormous yet, but a peach tree and a magnolia, and have other plants for other trees. We also have, I think, some quite old trees growing on the edge of our property along what used to be the fence line of a field. And you can still see the barbed wire in some of these trees. Really quite ancient trees remain in places where they were used for barbed wire fences. Because, of course, the barbed wire would have been put in them and they would have been preserved for a long time. And I've noticed that along this particular fence line. There's some very, very big oaks growing there.
Long before you were photographing trees, you were taking photographs.
Yes. I actually started taking photographs when I was quite small. My father was a photographer, not a professional photographer, but a serious amateur photographer, and he had a bunch of Nikons, and he would take pictures of everything. And he was very generous about just putting the camera in my hands when I was pretty small. And so we lived in Brooklyn Heights, and I would take pictures. And then in school, I naturally gravitated to photography courses and dark rooms. And in high school in particular, I did a lot of photography and took a camera with me everywhere, and also in the beginning of college. And at a certain point during college, I began to also realize I like to write. And I felt I had to make a decision for some reason, between writing and photography, I suppose, for a career. And at that point, writing seemed, photography I just loved and it was fun, but writing seemed more serious. So I decided I was a writer, and for the first years after college, I worked as a newspaper reporter. I did a lot of some freelance work. I worked on some travel guides. And then I got this job at the Parks Department really as a writer, and wrote their annual reports, wrote brochures, did all kinds of different, I was in charge of the correspondence for the agency, that kind of thing. And then I moved on to doing those publications there. But it was while I was there doing those publications that I found myself anyway still just taking pictures all the time, and realized I ought to take pictures for the publications. And so I came back to sort of serious photography there, and I began to, I basically used my job at the Parks Department to teach myself about photography and Photoshop and all the modern parts of photography. So I began photographing very seriously. I got a new camera. I learned about such things when photographing trees as perspective control and, you know, in color. And so that's really how I sort of came back to this thing that I just love to do anyway. And I realized at a certain point, and I realized this while doing my next book, which was Route 22, about a road going from Manhattan to Montreal up the eastern border of New York State. I realized when I started doing this book sort of spontaneously that photographing again was like having the other shoe on my feet, that I was actually meant in some way to be both writing and photographing together, and that they worked the best for me.
You had been working in the darkroom, I guess, before digital photography came along.
Yes, I've been working in a darkroom. For the work at the Parks Department, I didn't have really time to work in a darkroom, so we had stuff done by a photo lab, but it was all, you know, analog photography and black and white, traditional black and white silver gelatin prints.
How did the Route 22 book come about?
Well, Route 22 came about the same time that I was working on the Great Trees book, which was black and white. I had known Route 22 for my entire life. When I was a child, my grandparents had lived on it. We lived in Westchester. We lived on it for a while later on. When I was very small, we used to bicycle across the Brooklyn Bridge, and my mother one day said we were bicycling up this cobblestone street in Manhattan, and my mother said, "See this street? You know, it goes all the way to Canada." And I said, "What do you mean?" Well, she said, "Well, this street becomes, it's Route 22. It becomes Route 22, and it goes all the way to Canada." And this idea that this cobblestone street that I knew from New York City could get me all the way to Canada always excited my imagination. So years later, I was driving my daughter down Route 22, or along Route 22, and then I ended up coming back to the city by myself along the road, and I had my camera, a number of cameras with me at the time, and I just started taking pictures, and I just kept taking pictures along this beautiful upstate road, as it seemed to me then, starting in Hoosick Falls and going down through Austerlitz and Hillsdale and Columbia County towns and through Dutchess County. And in one evening, I got this whole body of beautiful sort of evocative photographs of this road, and that excited me. And sort of towards the end of the day, I found myself telling people that I was doing a project on Route 22. So after that, I would go for 3 or 4 days at a time and take trips up Route 22. It does go, as I argue, from the Battery, Battery Park in New York City, all the way to Montreal. It changes. It's got a different name in New York City, and it's got a different name over the Canadian border, but you can follow one road quite clearly, one historic road going all the way.
And you have photographs the entire length, I think, right?
Yes, I have photographs both starting from the Battery, pictures of New York Harbor, all the way up to pictures from Mount Royal, the highest point in Montreal.
And those are all analog photos.
Those are all analog photos. Well, you know, Richard, I still shoot film. At that point, I shot film and I had it developed. And at that point, and some of it I printed myself and some of it I had others print. In fact, for a time when I was at the Malay Colony as part of the Route 22 project, they have a great darkroom there, and I was able to do everything myself. It was really great. But in general, for my own work, I prefer to shoot on film and then scan it. And then once I scan it, I do everything else digitally. I have a digital printer, and I make my prints myself on that.
So even the New York City of Trees was
all shot on film?
All
shot on film, absolutely. The reason is that I love my camera so much. It's a square format Hasselblad, and although Hasselblad has moved into the digital era, it no longer has a square format. It has a horizontal format like every other camera. And in order to buy a digital back, which is the wrong shape, it costs $32,000, at least to get one that will work to the extent I would like. So, in fact, you can't buy a digital camera with a square back. Some of the little point-and-shoots you can turn into sort of modified squares, but for a serious camera, there's no square back. And I am very, at this point, wedded to the square. I've done 3 books with this camera, and I love it, and I don't really want to change.
And you're out taking photographs every day, pretty much?
As much as I can be, yes. I really, that's basically what I like to do.
You have other subjects you're pursuing now, other than trees, that is?
I have several other subjects, yes. Actually, one of the subjects involves using mainly photographs I've taken over the course of my life. I'm calling it the Diary of Lost Things, and it's actually an attempt to do a kind of autobiography in a memoir in photographs, but only photographs of things that no longer exist. The idea being that to really know a person, you have to know things that they experienced or saw that you actually will never see or experience because they are no longer with us. And if you look, one of the things about photography is when you're photographing something, you take the picture for whatever reason you're taking that particular picture. But inevitably, 20 years later, that picture means something entirely different. And you can never know when you're taking the picture what it's going to mean because you don't know where the world is going to go necessarily or where that object is going to go. And so I'm going back through all of my old photographs and looking for those pictures of things that can never be sort of re-photographed, in a sense, never would be seen. and trying to write about that, you know, a little essay, as in my other books, in connection with that photograph, and to see if what happens if I combine all those, what kind of story it ends up telling.
The other very interesting book is the Hudson Valley Cultural Guide.
I was very lucky. That was a commission. The Alliance for the Arts in New York City invited me to help put together this book. And since I have this skill both as a writer and a photographer, basically I did the whole thing under the guidance of Randall Borscheid, who at that time was the president of the Alliance. And it was very much his concept to do a cultural guide to the Hudson Valley. And by Hudson Valley, this means not just what one might think, in other words, everything above the New York City border, but it includes all of New York City, because, of course, New York City is part of the Hudson Valley as well. And there's this sort of false distinction that gets made that there's some separation geologically or geographically between the two, or culturally, but really, culturally as well, they're deeply connected. So I was able, in a very short time, because basically the book was meant to come out in time for the quadricentennial of Henry Hudson's sail up the Hudson River. That happened in 1609. So starting in 2007 and really in 2008, basically what I did, I had the great privilege of driving up and down the Hudson Valley and hiking. I went to the top of Mount Marcy to photograph Lake Tear of the Clouds, the source of the Hudson, and I went to all the cultural institutions I could find in the Hudson Valley. The focus of the book is not just sort of a guidebook to the valley and everything there, but it's specifically a cultural guide to the valley, the idea being that there are these interconnections among artists and among institutions that are displaying and making art available that go from the Staten Island up to the Adirondacks. I was able to photograph at Storm King Art Center. I took pictures in the Metropolitan Museum. I took pictures at the Hyde Museum upstate in the Adirondacks. At Art Omi, I took pictures, and of course at Olana and the Thomas Cole House and all the great places in Columbia County in this area as well.
And every one of them a little gem, I might add.
Well, I've always wanted to be able to print them big, actually, because some of them could do quite well that way.
I'm sure
one of my
could.
Favorite places to photograph was Empire State Plaza in Albany, actually, which, as you know, was built by Nelson Rockefeller as itself a kind of a cultural statement. And I happened to have been there yesterday and was reminded there are all these extraordinary works of art scattered around the place, including a whole sculpture series by David Smith.
Did you go back to some of these places several times?
Yes, I went back to quite a few of them several times, though some of them I just arrived and they were very welcoming and took pictures. So obviously some of the bigger institutions like Dia Beacon required, it was very hard to get permission, but they finally gave me permission to photograph there. It was quite extraordinary to think of all the artwork that is being produced and displayed up and down the Hudson Valley, and not only visual art, but performing works as well. I mean, there's the Bardavon Center, and there's so many other performing arts places places where music is played.
And, of course, the houses.
Yes, there's so many amazing historic houses up and down the Hudson Valley, exactly. I make appointments at as few places as I have to. I much prefer to show up, because often you can take pictures much more easily that way, and it's much more complicated getting permission. Often I had to get permission. Often I had to get permission after the fact, when I'd already taken a picture and needed to get approval because it contained a work of art that I needed the artist's permission to reproduce. But it's much better when you just are there, because you see what you want and you're not trying to imagine what you might get. I really prefer to take pictures that don't have to be where you don't have to set them up in advance. That's where the great thing about the trees is that they're always growing there and you don't really need permission to photograph them.
Right. Now, what drew you to Columbia County?
Well, while doing this guidebook, I ended up spending a lot of time in Columbia County, both because there's so much here, because it turns out I have friends here. During the Route 22 book, I was lucky to have a period of time at the Malay colony in Austerlitz, and so actually spent a lot of time here long before I really knew the place very well. And then I had a show of the Route 22 pictures at the Spencertown Academy a few years later. So again, I got to know Columbia County that way and got to realize how much is really going on here. And as an artist, I found myself drawn to the combination of sort of cultural activity in this area. And Hudson is, these days, is just booming with galleries and antique stores. And so I was drawn to that for that reason. Plus, it's the country. I mean, you know, one could live here and plant one's own trees. And, you know, my wife is very much loved the place as well, and she spent almost as much time here as I have. And so we, at a certain point, started looking for a place here, and we now have one. I mean, she still teaches in the city. My son goes to school there. So we, unfortunately, have to still divide our time between here and the city. But I spend a lot of time here. One of the, in for these latest photographs of trees, I decided that my job was to a certain extent to be a documentary photographer, and to a certain extent to be a sort of more aesthetic photographer, to take pictures that really, where the feeling of being inside that tree predominated. So I set myself a couple of rules in taking the pictures. And the primary rule was that I always had to show in the photograph the place where the trunk of the tree meets the ground. The idea being that that is how you could show the particularities of the tree, because a tree always grows in a particular place. And the form of the tree is very much a function of the relationship of the way that kind of tree grows with the particular place that's putting whatever restrictions on the tree. So I always wanted to show where the trunk meets the ground, which gives a sense of where the tree is growing, because all trees grow in a particular place, and that leads into sort of thoughts and discussions about what that tree might have sort of experienced during its lifetime, or what happened in that particular place. I started out photographing trees in a very rigid way. I have a perspective control device for my Hasselblad, which allows me to raise the lens and look up without having distortion, much as on a large view camera. And it seemed to me that I really didn't want to have any distortion, and I wanted to have, because trees should be straight. You don't want to see them, because otherwise, if you're looking up at a tree, the tree seems to be falling away from the camera. But with perspective control, it goes straight. So at first, I really thought was important to me. After a while, I began to realize that, for one thing, my perspective control lens increases the focal length of my lens, which means I have less of a wide angle when I use it. And I began to realize I wanted more of a wide angle with the pictures in order to get more of the tree in the picture. One of the important things for me, aside from the documentary aspect, aside from making sure I have where the trunk meets the ground, is to try to capture somewhat the feeling of being next to that tree. I get up close to the trees as much as I can, and inside them, and have them around me. And for that, it was most effective to have as wide a lens as I could have. So I began using the perspective control lens less and less. When there were buildings in the picture, it was important to have that more rigid approach, but especially for trees and parks that didn't have buildings right next to them, I was able to play with the distortion in a kind of a positive way. I began photographing in, I had always photographed in black and white, but doing the brochures for the Parks Department, I began photographing in color and learned about color and taught myself about what it meant to photograph in color. And for this tree project, that became how I did it. I guess when you're photographing in color, you could maybe show a little more the effects of seasonal change on trees, the particular tones of blossoms and colors of the trees turn in the fall, come out more strongly. And I think you can get very much the sense, the same sense of the form of the tree that you can get in black and white photography. These days, I find myself in some ways often going back to black and white work. And I think my next project will be black and white.
Do you sometimes take black and white photographs of the trees you photographed in color?
Usually not at the same at the same time. I like to try to, when I'm taking pictures, be pretty narrow in terms of my technical focus. Otherwise, there's too much to think about. So I tend to go out, you know, I'm there with one lens and maybe the possibility of that perspective control back and one kind of film, and that's what I'm thinking about at the time. To then jump into black and white, I used to try that, but it just adds too much complexity, and you can't really focus on the photography that way.
Do you mount the camera on a tripod?
Yes, I do mount the camera on the tripod, and I have a level on the camera. And for those cameras without the perspective control lens, those photographs without the perspective control lens, I sort of ignore the level to a certain extent. You know, I once, the great photographer Lee Friedlander, I happened, I think by mistake, to be invited to a very select opening of one of his shows. And I went, and there he was, and there I was. I found myself talking to Lee Friedlander, whose photographs I had always admired. So I didn't quite know what to say to Mr. Friedlander, so I said, "Do you use a level?" Not quite the thing you'd say to someone at a sort of cocktail party opening type of thing. But he said, "Well, really, I don't use a level. In fact, I really don't like using a tripod anymore." And I thought that was actually a very useful piece of information, and I like that. I find that I need to use the level for these perspective control shots with buildings and things like that. But I also appreciate the sort of more, and I've cultivated to a certain extent also that sort of more free-form approach that Friedlander was talking about.
Do you take snapshots?
Of course. I have a family. I'm always taking pictures of my family. And also because you take pictures. I mean, I carry a camera with me everywhere and take pictures of everything I see. And, you know, so these days digital little point-and-shoots are so great, you can actually make some great prints out of little pictures you take with the camera.
You have a bunch of cameras?
I do have a bunch of cameras. One of my favorite cameras is an old film camera called a Plowbill. It's a 6 centimeter by 7 centimeter medium format camera. So it's a medium format camera that uses every inch of that medium format film, but is horizontal. So it goes further even than the square format of the Hasselblad. But this camera is a portable camera. It's a bellows camera that folds out. So when you put it back together again, you can stick it in your pocket. It's so big, it only fits in a huge, you know, coat pocket. And you can only take 10 exposures with it. But the Plowbill is an extraordinary, has this very sharp Nikon lens, slightly wide angle, and it takes actually wonderful portraits. And I like taking you know, portraits of people with it and then architectural pictures with it. I've been using that a lot recently.
How do you spell that, Plowbill?
P-L-A-U-B-E-L. It's called the Plowbill Machina, and it's actually was discontinued in the 70s. It's no longer made, but it's this great camera, and it's built like a tank. It weighs so much. I need a camera to do certain things, so I wanted to have the best medium format camera that I could carry around with me, because the Hasselblad is big, and you can I have a backpack I can stick it in, but it just requires more, whereas this Machina is small. You can stick it in your pocket and bring it around a little more discreetly. The disadvantage of a rectangular back is that you have to be always turning the camera or turning the back if you want horizontal or vertical pictures. Whereas with a square camera, you never have to turn anything. It's just all there, and you can crop it later if you want, or keep it as it is. So,
what do you usually do, crop it or keep it as it is?
I generally keep it as it is, because when I'm taking the picture, I'm trying to fill every inch of that square with something. But often when I'm taking pictures, I will realize I'm going to need to crop it later because it's just impossible to get in the right position to avoid, you know, the mirror of the car sticking into part of the frame or something like that. You know, you're backed into corners trying to get things into the picture, and there's just a picture that just has to be horizontal for some reason. I mean, there's just some really boring pavement in the front, and the rest of it is the picture. So you crop that off. I like to have it be that you, when you're taking the picture, you see the finished print in your mind's eye. I can't remember, was it Ansel Adams or Ansel Adams who said that? But you pre-visualize the photograph.
Thank you very much, Benji, for coming in and talking.
You're welcome. Well, it's such a pleasure, Richard. I really enjoyed speaking with you, such an old friend, about these things.
And now to finish the hour, Joan Baez singing Bob Dylan, Love Minus Zero, No Limit.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true, like ice, like fire. People carry roses. Stores and bus stations. failures, no success at all. Cloak and dagger dangles, madams light the candles, and ceremonies of the horsemen, even the pawn must hold a grudge. Crumble into one another. My love winks, she does not bother. She knows too much to argue or to judge. The bridge at midnight trembles. The country doctor rambles. Banker's nieces seek perfection, expecting all that wise men bring. The wind howls like a hammer, the night blows cold and rainy. My love, she's like some raven at my window with a broken wing.